Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and we have Beth Pierce with us. Beth is the Vice President of the National Association of Realtors, and she is a broker owner of Primetime Properties in Century City, California. She's been a broker for over 35 years. She's won awards for being the Realtor of the Year in California, and she's been a delight to talk to. So, Beth, welcome back.
Thank you.
I'm pretty good at math, so you got into the business just about the time that interest rates were
skyrocketing,
going crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that one thing that we really forget is that usually there's some volatility attached to our industry. We haven't had a prime rate change in 5 years. The year that you, and I have to study this because I try to figure all this stuff out, the most volatile year ever, if I recall correctly, was 1980 or 81.
I think you're right.
You had 21 changes by the Fed.
Right. And all up.
Well, and you know what, can you imagine you're in escrow for 45 days and you have three rate changes?
Yeah, that's when they were trying to lock in rates, and they didn't really allow that. And it was a disaster, because once they qualified, they thought, oh, okay, I qualified for my loan, and I'm so excited. And then, oh, sorry, you're going to have to re-qualify at the new interest rate. So, and those interest rates were in the 18, 19. I had a client who had to get a loan at 21% at one time. So when people talk about these rates going up now, and I'm talking about 4.5% to maybe they'll go to 4.75% or 5%. Come on. Fabulous thing.
When I have a friend, Sean O'Toole, and I, and he owns Foreclosure Radar, and we just do research, and we actually went back to Washington, D.C., to the archives, Library of Congress, and we were interested to see if interest rates were at their lowest in our lifetime. And so we literally went back to microfiche all the way to 1850 and looked at newspapers.
Wow.
So from 1850 on, we looked at a Sunday paper once a month and looked at the real estate ads for interest rates.
Right.
And for a fact, interest rates were never lower in our entire lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so, you know, going back to affordability, that's what that correlates to. When we had the downturn of all the prices and you matched it with an interest rate, ownership became kind of a no-brainer. And yet the part that you said showed up is very true. People were afraid to do it.
Absolutely. And you just almost couldn't understand it. You talked to the younger people and you said, come on, this is the time to get into real estate. And I still say that. I mean, interest rates are just still at all-time lows. And while prices have increased, they are not out of sight. They are much lower than they were. And I just don't understand why somebody would say, I used to actually teach a class in the difference between renting and home ownership and what you could do and what the difference was. And when you actually showed people what the difference was between renting that two-bedroom, two-bath condo versus buying it, you really got people to say, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. And then they'd buy. And I think that's something we should be showing people again now.
Well, the part that's you can't quantify is the psychology of why people do things, okay? But simultaneously to an owner hesitating, let's say at the bottom of a market, lenders hesitate to make loans at the bottom of market. Legislation is on the other side of it saying, okay, we have to restrain all this stuff exactly at the perfect time to go, no, now you could be aggressive.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
Some of this, you know, we'll talk now a little bit about Dodd-Frank. Now, some of this, our industry inflicted on ourselves. You know, we should have reined in some of those programs willingly, and they ran amok, and now we've got Dodd-Frank. So let's talk about, now that was written several years ago, and I still don't know that we know 100% what it has turned out to be? Are all the pieces in place now?
We can't answer that either,
okay,
to be honest with you. And I don't think that most people in Congress can answer that. So that makes quite a problem. And interpretation of it, et cetera, is, I think Lawrence Young, our chief economist, probably can. But other than that, it's a very difficult bill to figure out what exactly they're saying and what is okay and what isn't.
Okay, well, what are the ramifications of that being true? So do you have lenders just literally just not willing to do any new programs because of that, because they're not sure that, in fact, it's okay?
Well, I think that's very true. I think our lenders have been very hesitant and some of them very stringent in making loans. What we kind of jokingly say at when some of us get together is lenders will be perfectly willing to make a loan to anyone who does not need one.
Exactly.
And part of that is joking, and part of that is honestly true. So we are trying to be sure. That's why you can't get rid of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac without that government guarantee, because you have to have a source for people to get a loan. If they are qualified, they should be able to get a loan, and that's what we're fighting for.
When you say guarantee, what do you mean by that exactly? Do you mean that that a loss would be absorbed by the government?
Well, you know, there weren't losses up until loans were being made that no one had a right to make.
Exactly.
And the government was buying loans that they should not have been willing to buy because they did not meet any of the standards that they said they were going to be meeting. So what we need is good laws in place that tell us exactly what the rules are, and then everyone to follow those rules. And I think if people had been following the rules even then, the situation would not have happened. So I'm not as worried that the government will end up, as you say, the government is now making a lot of money on making loans in Fannie Mae. And so I think that it really is a wonderful program. And you do have to have a government guarantee. There's no question that, you know, people say, well, I don't want my taxpayer money to go there. Well, every cent of that was paid back.
It was.
And now they're making a very lovely profit on it. So, yes, it was a bad time, but because people broke the law, not because of the law, but because people broke it and nobody stopped them.
You know, that's the hardest thing to prevent is an overreaction. And an overreaction on both sides.
Right.
So when times were good, we kept on doing more and more generous things because the mandate was everyone has to own a house. And so we forgot that somebody was actually supposed to qualify. But now we've reverted to such a stance that the people that are self-employed have a lot slimmer chance to own a house.
Absolutely.
And there's so many no answers being given to such a safe pool of loans. I'm wondering if there isn't some private sector lender that's going to capture a decent share of business by having aggressive programs if there was enough money to fund it. And that's the biggest thing. When you're talking about what do Fannie and Freddie hold, something like over $5 trillion of mortgages?
I believe that's the number.
Right. So how do you, you know, when you listen to people talk about they're going to raise funds for buying rental homes, and then it's a big number, $3 billion. And you go, well, wait a minute. You're talking about an industry where you probably need, and you would know the numbers maybe than I, what are the numbers in hundreds of billions of dollars of transactions a year? You know, when you have, if you take away Fannie and Freddie, you better replace them with some capacity to fund or guarantee.
Right. And we don't really believe that there are private funds that will jump in and do that. We really don't. Never seen it happen before. Can't imagine why it's going to happen now. So before they do away with it, as opposed to just restructuring it, we want proof for our clients, for our constituents, that there's going to be money there for the average person to go buy a home.
What was NAR's position and how did it lessen the impact of the Dodd-Frank bill in the last few years? Because I know you've been lobbying all constantly for certain things to end up in certain places. So there's all kinds of categories in Dodd-Frank. What were some of the victories that you guys had where you went, okay, well, I'm glad that it changed to this?
Well, we've talked about the qualified residential mortgages, the QRMs and the QMs. And the qualified mortgage rule set standards for strong loans, but it didn't make the banks hold more capital.
Okay.
And that's a big thing. And they're underwriting regular standards, and those loans are performing well. So now we are trying to monitor that and make sure that there's credit that's availability. They came out with this rule that said the qualified residential mortgages, what we call the QRMs. We do a lot of letters for real words, so I'm trying to use both of them. And what they're saying was that you had to have a 10% down payment. Well, not everybody can come up with a 10% down payment. And so they're trying to change what the rules were for the qualified mortgages and make and base them back on what the same rules were, and that for loans that are going to be sold into securities or sold to investors. And they're requiring that the banks hold a lot more capital on those loans, which is fine. We're not saying that they can't make rules, but you don't want to then change the basic rule, which was if a person can qualify to buy the home, then they're qualified. Why are you changing the rule just because of where it's being sold?
I think there's definitely...
I'm not sure I explained it carefully enough. But.
Sure. No, I thought that was great. What's interesting, because you, as I listen, something else kicks off in my mind. There's an assumption that a bigger down payment makes a payment history, a successful payment history, more likely. And yet, I don't know if you've ever seen a chart for a long period of time of a VA loan with nothing down.
Right.
It mimics the best of
the
Fannie
best
and Freddie.
Of all the loans.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And that's been proven time after time after time. It is not the down payment, the amount of the down payment that shows whether or not the person will make it. It's their credit history, and it's qualifying them based on them being able to afford to live in that home. And if you qualify them based on that, whether they put 2% down or 25% down, the same people are going to make those payments. And as you said, the VA loans are the perfect example, especially in California. We can show that to you over and over and over again.
Well, I'm just curious, what's your opinion of why charts that are, you know, historical and lengthy sometimes don't make an impact? In other words, there's people that absolutely still, okay, when you put down 20% of, even the head of the FDIC,
right.
I may remember a quote she said, of course, if somebody puts 20% down, they're much more likely to make their payment. What's the difference between, if you have a chart that says, well, wait a minute, what you're saying makes perfect sense, except for it doesn't pan out that way.
Exactly.
You'd think you'd have maybe a willingness to change your mind, since you're about to change an entire industry for the negative. Don't do it on a false conclusion.
And don't do it just on what you assume would happen.
Exactly.
Go look at the records and see. We spend a lot of time lobbying and trying to show them. And as I said, Lauren Kuhn is our chief economist at the National Association. And here in California, we have Leslie Appleton Young, who does the same thing for Californians. And they'll show you time after time these statistics and why we say what we say. But there are some lawmakers who say, don't confuse us with facts. You know? And it's very difficult. We walk into their offices, and they're really not going to listen. They have their mind made up. So we spend a lot of time and energy, and as do all our realtors who go to Washington or go to Sacramento and try and lobby and try and get people to at least listen and be logical about what their conclusions are.
I think one of the difficulties, and this is, you know, to be fair, I guess, on anybody that's in Congress, is that they deal with a lot of subjects, not just real estate. So the thought that they have expertise necessary to discuss this, I don't know what percentage of them even would understand what you and I have just been talking about, just because that's not what they did.
I agree with you, and that's why we need more realtors in Congress and in the state houses. And we do spend time training our realtors on how to run for public office, even if it's the Planning Commission or whatever their local group needs, because you do need people with the basic knowledge of that subject. Whether it would be, obviously I'm interested in it being realtors and people who understand real estate, but if it's somebody who's a tax specialist, that certainly helps, you know, your government to run correctly. We do have some realtors in Congress right now, and we are very pleased because they seem to know and to work to get things that make logical sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thrilled when they get elected. So if you'd like to run, please feel free to let us know.
That I wasn't ready for. That's funny.
Sorry.
No, I don't think I'll be doing that, but I enjoy this end of it, though.
Okay.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Okay, now that's a new government entity that's now in full force. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Okay.
And I'm not an expert on that, so I don't know that I'll be able to answer.
Just in general, what's the intent of it? Is the intent that it's going to try to prevent making loans to people that really shouldn't be given financing?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, I really don't.
I've heard different things of what their real thought pattern is, but I honestly don't know.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, you're in a situation where apparently there's just a lot of layers to deal with. And I guess that's kind of what I was ultimately going to get to, is that we've created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on top of what's already there, sometimes on top of what already was there before that. Do people in the mortgage business and realtors start looking at all these regulations going, there's some conflicts and there's some confusion, and you just wonder, why do we need so many hats and so many different rules?
Well, of course, we all think that. You know that from being an investor. You say, wait a minute, you already have six people who are dealing with that right down the street. Why are you starting another commission or another idea? But, you know, we understand that everybody is trying to make sure that what happened 5 years ago doesn't happen again. And nobody has a problem with that. We all think that's a great idea. But why don't we use those rules that we have, enforce them, and go from there? So that's my personal opinion. Not an NAR necessary.
Right. And, you know, I don't think it's helpful to be punitive at this point.
No, that doesn't do anyone any good.
No, it doesn't help an economy. It doesn't help the couple that could have owned a home that doesn't.
Right.
What about policies like immigration? So we keep on batting that subject around. And so you have, let's say we have something similar as in the Reagan years happened in 2014. I'm just curious what you think the impact of real estate would be if we, in fact, had immigration reform.
Well, I think there's going to be immigration reform. I really do. I think it's time. And, you know, I've had fabulous experiences with immigrants who come to this country who want to be part of the United States. So I'm probably not even a fair judge. I've never had someone who came from, I've had a lot of Asian buyers in my particular area, because I've always sold in the San Fernando Valley too. And these people come wanting to be part of America, and to them that means owning a piece of it. So I think it's worked out phenomenally. I do not have, where's the wood, I do not have a client who ever went into foreclosure. I did some pre-qualifying today. They say, oh, you can't do that because you're asking personal questions. Well, if they want me to find them a home, I'm going to want to know personal things about them. So, yeah, I guess maybe that wouldn't be politically correct, but none of my clients ever objected, so I was very happy. And once you find the price range that they're comfortable in and can afford to make those payments, I think immigrants make fabulous buyers because they're the people who came here because they wanted to be here and they wanted to be part of America. So
now, sometimes they personally show up, but sometimes their money shows up. So in California, about 8% of real estate sold went to foreign investors, and that percentage is, you know, it's a lot health. I don't know if the healthy is the right word. It's a lot bigger than it was in the past 3 or 4 years.
Well, they're seeing the bargains. You know, they're saying the same thing. Real estate's at an all-time low. Why am I not buying it? You know. So as long as we have the laws that say that, you know, there are many countries that say that foreigners, that's us, cannot buy coastal property or cannot buy farmland. We don't have any rules like that. So, yeah, they're going to come in and they're going to buy what they consider to be the best buys out there. I don't personally deal with a lot of foreign investors, so I'm not as expert in that field as you probably are and know about. I mostly dealt with people whose kids were going to UCLA or whatever, and they wanted them. They did not want to rent. And when you said to them, well, your child's only going to be here for another 3 years, are you thinking about renting instead? They'd look at you like you were crazy and say, well, why would I pay somebody else money instead of having the house myself?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I say, could you say that to the rest of my people?
Yeah, I guess I'm unintentionally being quite promotive of real estate, just because it certainly has been a big deal for me and my family. And I guess that's why you get in the industry, is that you think, you know what, this has treated me well, so
right.
I'm going to talk about it.
Right, and that's I think the same for many of us. I got in it from my mom, and you know, you got in it because from a personal experience, you found that, gee, this is a great way to do things.
I just didn't know how else to pay off a house quicker than in California. You know, it happens to go up, and started studying cycles and stuff. You know, the one thing that's been very interesting during the time that I've been involved, you know, when I got married very young, so I'm off the charts on the other way. I got married at 17, but my generation generally got married in their early 20s. This generation doesn't do that.
Nope.
And so, you know, you look at all the charts of household formation that's supposed to happen, and I think it's about to happen, but these kids didn't do what everyone else did. They didn't get married at 22. They get married at 29.
Right, but I do think that you're seeing something, a different phenomenon, and that is single people buying homes.
Absolutely.
And because I began to see it, I used to work for a company called Glendale Federal Bank, and I ran their real estate, part of their real estate division, and we had a phenomenon that started of single women buying homes, and that was something nobody even thought to tap that market, and including me, who was a single woman at the time. And all of a sudden, I found that we had a tremendous amount of buyers in the single woman class, and now we're seeing a great many young men at 25, 28, they got out of school, they got their first jobs, they're working, and they're ready to buy. And when you say to them, well, is there a family involved? They say, there will be.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not, they don't seem to care. They want a house. They want a place to have their friends over. And they don't want to pay rent anymore.
So. We've only got a minute left. The product that they're interested in, do they still want a yard or they want to live on the fifth story of a high-rise?
It depends. Most of them want to live on the fifth story of a high-rise.
Really?
Yeah.
And the reason I ask this question is because of where you are in that area, I think that might make sense.
Exactly. And I was just going to say that. But depending on where your marketplace is, I'll bet that answer changes drastically. Where, gee, I want a pool for my friends to come over, or, gee, I want a backyard where we can throw around the football, you know. But where I live, most people can't afford the houses at that point. But they can't afford the condominium.
So that kind of skews the answer.
Yeah,
if they could, maybe they would want it anyway.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, Beth, we've run out of time. We've been speaking with Beth Pierce, and it's been a pleasure. She's the Vice President of the National Association of Realtors. And Beth, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.